This podcast is brought to you by Soapbox. Start your own podcast today at www.soapbox.host.
I am a spirit. I once was very happy, but I have been disturbed and made unhappy. I am the spirit of a person who was buried in the woods nearby, and the grave was disturbed. My bones disinterred and scattered, and one of my teeth was lost under this house. I am here looking for that tooth. The Bell Witch. Tonight we'll hear part one of the disturbing legend of the Bell Witch and the unendurable terror she inflicted on the Bell family back in the early 1800s in Tennessee. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 12. Welcome, Aaron and Nick, joining me as always. I hope you're excited. This is a story that I've wanted to tell now for, since the very beginning.
7 years.
Honestly, 7 years when I first heard it. But before we get into the many pages, I think Nick said 14 pages. Mm-hmm. He copy-pasted my notes. 14 pages of notes. Let's start, as we always do, with some shout-outs. So I will quick shout-out Sarah. And especially Sarah's episode in our podcast, which is Be Crazy, since there's a small connection to that story here that we'll touch on. How about you, Nick?
Shout out to my mother, of course, and Maddie, and David Hoy, if you're still listening. And shout out to Forrest and Scott from Astonishing Legends for putting Frank on this path.
Yes, yes. And I'll start with that. How about you, Aaron?
I got a shout out to Fallon, of course, and a shout out to Troy from Nick, and lastly a shout out to the Bell Witch for making this possible,
for sponsoring this episode so many centuries later.
Go check out her merch at bell.witch.
They definitely have merch in Tennessee. They have like a whole tourist set up around the area.
Yeah, she'll be on the Talk to a podcast.
Next episode of the Bell Witch, also known as Kate's Witch, which we will touch on. So, without further ado, few stories have stuck with me years and years and years after hearing them, and tonight's story is perhaps the best example. As Nick alluded to, I heard this story 7 years ago on one of my favorite podcasts of all time, Astonishing Legends. We'll have the link in the show notes to the two episodes that they do on this story. So I listened to this first when taking home the BXM8 express bus from Manhattan to the Bronx, going through the dark city, putting in earbuds and listening to these spooky stories. It's claimed to be one of the best documented paranormal encounters in all of American history, whose fame spread so wide that even there are stories of, at the time, future President Andrew Jackson taking note and having some experiences of his own. I'm going to attempt to do the story justice myself tonight, so bear with me. Before I start, I'd just like to gauge how much of the story do you guys know? So, Nick.
I listened to the Astonishing Legends episode when Frank introduced me freshman year. I remember listening to it walking back from work study at like midnight. And I'm looking around. I'm looking up in windows on campus, just like really freaked out. So I haven't listened to it in a while. I'll probably remember
half a decade ago.
Yeah, more than that.
Wow.
And so it's been a while since I've heard it, but things will come back to me. There are things I do remember from it that I'm sure Frank will get into here. But Frank also showed us some stuff that I had not heard of. So
yeah, a lot of details always get filtered out. But I went to the oldest sources we have. How about you, Aaron?
So I believe I listened to part of those episodes way back in the day, and I was not giving it my full attention like I should have, and so I didn't really remember any of the details. So I'm sure as you say things, I'll be like, oh yeah, that's right. But I'm kind of going in blind here.
Wonderful. As I assume most of our listeners will as well. So let's start. The story starts in 1817 in the sleepy little town of Adams, Tennessee. If you look at the map, you could see that Adams is situated on the banks of the Red River in Robertson County. And this is on the central northern border of Tennessee. At the time, in 1817, Tennessee was a frontier state. Right? 1817 is like before the classic Western pioneer time, right? So this is still really new. The country is still quite young. So I want you guys to really imagine dense forests as far as the eye could see, rustic, isolated living, log cabins built by their inhabitants. The people who lived in these regions at the time had to be, to survive, very resourceful and self-reliant people. As author M.V. Ingram puts it, who wrote the book that will be the main source of tonight's story, quote, "Couriers carried back the glad tidings of peace and safety, and a glowing account of the rich lands, fine forest, great watercourses, rivers, creeks, brooks, and bubbling springs. In short, the land of milk and honey had been discovered in Tennessee." So this really paints a beautiful picture of the region at the time.
It's a nice place.
It really is. I guess so.
And then industrialization happened and all those forests went away.
Yeah. I wonder, I've never been to Tennessee. Have either of you guys?
Yes.
Nope.
Really?
Yeah, I have. I actually went on a ghost tour in Tennessee.
Really?
Civil War stuff, I believe. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Can you confirm the creeks, brooks, bubbling
this
springs?
This was like a decade ago, man.
Was it the land of milk and honey?
You know, I think it just might be.
No, it's the land of hot honey Nashville chicken.
Nice. Even better. So as we imagine this rustic environment, let's talk about the Bell family. The Bell family, their history in Tennessee dates back to 1804 when John Bell Sr., there are going to be a lot of names, so remember John Bell Sr., who I'll refer to typically as John Bell, moved with his wife Lucy and their children from North Carolina to Robertson County. I will be the first to admit, I didn't know that these two states touch each other. I know Nick's face bombing right now. I swear to you, I thought these were like, this was like the longest trek in the world. And I'm like, oh my God, they're next to each other. So that makes a lot of sense. At the time, people really had not moved very deep into the country into the unexplored territory. He purchased about 1,000 acres of land along the Red River, as all settlements at the time were pretty much along rivers. And this property had a 1.5-story double log cabin with 6 rooms, 2 halls, barns on the property, an orchard. And he proceeded to clear out the surrounding land to form really nice big farms. They had 9 children. And they lost one in childhood, as was common back then. And they also had a number of slaves.
And we're in the South.
Yes.
And it is pre-Civil War.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And overall, they were a very well-respected family in the area. They had moved amongst friends that previously had moved from North Carolina, where they were from. So they moved to a region where everyone kind of knew each other. Everyone was friendly. They had family. A very close-knit community. And John Bell Sr., the patriarch, was considered to be a very good estate manager, a very hard worker, and a good father. And his wife Lucy, the matriarch, very dutiful in her domestic affairs, greatly devoted to her children, to their upbringing, very loving mother. And, like many in the area at this time, they were all devout Baptists. When I say devout Baptists, I mean, in their free time, all they did was get together and hang out and pray and sing and like shake. And that features a lot in this story. Not everyone in the region.
Sorry. Yeah. By shake, do you mean dance or do you mean like physically just shake?
Like they were having a seizure?
Shake as in the Quakers and the Shakers. Are you familiar with the Quakers and the Shakers?
I am not.
Of Quaker Oats fame?
I know yeah. him.
I mean, you know, Quaker Oats. I've heard of Quaker Oats.
So it's originally named after the religious group, the Quakers. And yep. the Shakers, I think, were an offshoot of the Quakers. And they were Protestant groups that were known for literally like physically shaking in their like during their religious practice, the fervor they had. They'd be like, ugh.
Oh, so they were the original televangelists.
Yeah, basically when you see clips of people being like, ah, shalala, ding-la, la-la, and they shake.
Yeah.
The Shakers and Quakers preceded them. Not everyone in the region was Baptist, but they were all different related Protestant groups and they all got along. Now, as I said, they moved in early 1800 and for 13 years, they lived a normal and happy life on their property. But that was about to change in the summer of 1817. Now, 1817, this is right after the War of 1812. So the U.S. is recovering and booming. James Monroe is the new president. The Erie Canal Project had just started.
Yeah, respect.
Yeah, right near us. Westward expansion kind of really kicked off. So this was a really dynamic and exciting time for the country. And by this time, the Bells had become a pretty rich and influential family. And they were really well respected for their character and hospitality. Just like Sarah and I, there I'll say, they hosted frequent social gatherings at their home. Now, hopefully, unlike Sarah and I, is what happened next. And I hope we don't end up like them if we keep doing our gatherings. Their children at this time in 1817 were growing up. And most notably, their daughter, Elizabeth, who was called Betsy, was, quote, ripening into lovely girlhood. Kind of creepy, but she was 12 at the time. Oof. Of course, like, back then, you know.
I feel like ripening is not the right word. Maybe blossoming is a better word.
Yes, I agree. I'm quoting the book, but yes, oh, I would hesitate to use that word.
Just be careful quoting the book too much.
Yes, yes. She drew the attention of many local boys, especially Joshua Gardner. Keep that name in mind. And now, this whole story survives for over two centuries, thanks to the Bell family passing it down and writing down their experiences, and eventually publishing their own book, and also having a book called An Authenticated History of the Famous Bell Witch by M.V. Ingram in 1894. So some 70-odd years after the fact, which has pretty much a compilation of all the stories written down by the family and his own research. And it seems like the entire original book just kind of in the middle of his book, which is really nice for me because I was able to find it for free, whereas the original book was not free. So I encourage you to look at the show notes for the PDF. It's 366 pages of crazy, crazy stuff. And as I tell the stories today, I want to emphasize a fraction of what happened to that family made it to pen and paper. And a fraction of that made it into the published books. There's 14 pages of stuff, but that's a fraction of what actually happened. Kind of crazy. And the descendants waited until the generation that experienced these things firsthand had all passed away before publishing out of a respect to them. Back to the story. One summer day in 1817, the father, Mr. John Bell Sr., was taking a stroll through his cornfield, as usual, when he was confronted by a strange animal, unlike any he had ever seen. It sat silently in a corn row, gazing at him as he drew closer, trying to make out what he was seeing. At the distance he was, he thought it was just a dog or something like that. So he pulled his gun out and shoots a warning shot near it to scare it off. And it promptly runs away. Some days later, his son Drew observed a wild turkey perched upon the fence, and he was like, oh, that's a meal. So he quickly ran inside for a gun to kill it. As he crept up to it, it flapped its wings and sailed off, leaving him stunned because it was no turkey, but some enormous unknown bird. Shortly after this, Betsy was on an evening walk with some of the other children among the big forest trees near the house when she saw a human figure swinging from a tree. Now, it's not swinging like hanging by a neck.
Oh,
I know. That's what I thought when I first read it. But no, it was, she reported it was a pretty little girl dressed in green swinging on a limb of a tall oak, just playing. Soon after, one of their slaves, Dean, started to report being tailed by a terribly large black dog every time he passed a certain spot on the road as he would travel to visit his wife at night. These first encounters were pretty small, one-off things. And again, they're in a new environment. They're in a new land. And at the time, there was this understanding or feeling of the West, the Western frontier, as being like wild, almost like a devil land, right? They associated the devil with where Jesus was tempted. Or sorry, they associated the desert with where Jesus was tempted by the devil. So they're not, you know, they're not super surprised to see strange stuff. But as odd as this is, they kind of, you know, they shrug it off. However, the strangeness started to move towards their own home. And this is where we'll start hearing of more familiar phenomena. The family began to hear strange knockings at the door. Oh my God, who just knocked at my door? One second. Oh my God, no way I just said knockings at the door and my door just knocked. Hold up. No way. The family began to hear strange knockings at the door and outside walls of the house, though they could never catch who was doing it. Now, according to their son at the time, Richard Williams, who, when this was starting, was only 6 years old, but this went on for years, and he's the one who actually kind of wrote down all a diary and notes and eventually had this stuff published. This went on for a long time, and John Bell Sr., the dad, always assumed it was a prankster, right? He actually never told his kids until it got too obvious, and he tried to keep it a secret, and he would always kind of run out and try to see if he could catch the prankster, but he never could. Eventually, though, it moved from the outside walls to the inside, and it could not be hidden from the kids anymore. Odd noises would come from the boys' room, sounding like, ready for this list of...
Yep.
I'm gonna pause after this and ask you guys what you think about these noises. Ready?
Okay.
They heard noises ranging from rats gnawing on bedposts, dogs fighting, chains dragging across the floor, smacking lips, heavy stones crashing on the ground, choking and strangulation, chairs being flung and falling over, and large wings flapping against the ceiling. Isn't that a fun list?
Yeah.
I mean,
hear me out.
Okay. I'm hearing you, Nick.
You know, they're in new land. It's out west, Native American land. It's just like the gnomes, man.
Yeah.
It's just the little people. they're just having a ball. Maybe literally.
The dogs fighting, like, it's like the most bizarre.
Hey, if Michael Vick can do it, so can they.
Whoa.
It was a,
allegedly.
Is that a dog fighter or something? Like a,
I think he was a quarterback that got, he was like betting on dog fights or something.
Oh, damn. So now, a little interesting detail is that these would happen in the dark. And the moment a candle was lit to investigate, the noises would stop. But as soon as they would stop in the boys' room, screams would be heard from Betsy's room.
Okay, maybe it's not.
She'd start screaming that something was after her, and she'd just be terrified, just terrified, unable to sleep. And they didn't just take it. They didn't just go, okay, whatever. They'd overturn rooms searching for rats, for dogs, any source of the sound, signs that things are being, you know, tossed and scraped and scratched. They would never find anything. And this, as you can imagine, began to weigh on them pretty, you know, mentally, keeping them from sleeping and increasingly focusing on Betsy. Now, one night that Richard Williams recalled, the family had retired to bed early, and Richard had just fallen asleep when he suddenly felt his hair begin to twist, and he was yanked up out of bed by his hair, feeling like the top of his head was just, you know, ripped off. And that same moment, his brother Joel, beside him in bed, screamed in fear. And immediately after that, Betsy in her room starts screaming that something's yanking her hair. So it goes from noises to knockings to sounds to now gripping hair and waking people up and keeping them up at night. Before I continue, do I still have your, you know, suspension of belief or anything? Because if you don't believe up to this part, you're going to have a bad time.
I mean,
a bad time.
Some of the noises, I was thinking like, okay, could it just be like an animal got in the house? Like they left the window open or something and an owl flew in and started like flapping his wings and knocking stuff over. But then you're like, oh no, they turned the room and didn't see any like damage or anything. I'm like, that's a little weird. Now the mice gnawing, that could have just been like in the walls or something. Like, I don't know. I feel like those noises, some of them could be explained, but then others, like the dogs barking, that's a little tougher to explain unless they're just hearing it outside the window and there's like coyotes or something.
And some sources said that it was sounds of chained dogs fighting, not just like separate noises of chains and dogs, but like specifically like chained dog fights happening, which is bizarre. I mean, it's just bizarre. But yeah, so yeah, good points. And I keep in mind as we go through all these, like, imagine what are the possible explanations for this?
The kids are making it up.
Yeah, right. Are the kids making it up? Is there a conspiracy here? Is it a cover for something else going on?
What would that be covering?
I don't know, like abuse by the parents.
Oh, I guess.
You know, something like that.
Coping.
Yeah, right. Well, the children continue to interact with this. I'm going to start calling it at this point an entity or a spirit, having their bed sheets frequently yanked off of them as well. And as you can imagine, they're a rich, influential, well-respected family in a community that they all know. This was extremely disturbing and embarrassing to them. They refused, and John Bell Sr. forbade anyone from telling anyone outside of the family about this. They did not want publicity. They did not want to try to figure out how to profit off of it. These were Baptists. They thought, you know, this is terrible. This is evil. They wanted to end and be forgotten. But the entity grew harder and harder to ignore. John Bell Sr. started to develop a strange stiffness of the tongue, which would just start and end randomly and would last for hours, sometimes even days, where he couldn't speak or eat during the spell. And he described it as feeling like a small stick of wood cross in his mouth, pressing out both cheeks was there. Anytime he'd try to eat, it's like the food would be pushed right out. This went on for a year, and he tried keeping this secret from even his immediate family until it got so bad that he just couldn't hide it. But I'm just saying, yeah.
How do you hide that for a year? Like, yeah. Certainly at dinner time, they'd be like, hey, Dad, what's going on? You're not eating your food.
Yeah.
And then he just doesn't answer them. Like, how?
It started
did you
as
not
a,
talk to them?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It started off as very small bursts of time, like a few minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and he was just hide it because he was really embarrassed by it. And eventually came to a point where, as you'll see, it was the least of their concerns. And they couldn't hide it anymore. Eventually, this knocking and the noises got so bad and their children couldn't sleep at night that they, you know, finally gave in and they told their best friends and their close neighbors, James Johnson and his wife. And they begged them to let the Bell family stay overnight at the Johnson's home, hoping that Mr. Johnson would be able to shed some light on the mystery. And this is because James Johnson was known to have a deep, deep understanding of the Bible.
Mm.
And then they were like...
But the Protestant version.
The Protestant Bible, yes, with some different book selections. And they were just like, maybe he'll know. He'll know how to help us. So Mr. Johnson was like, sure, of course. This sounds strange. They went over that day, the whole family, and at night came and they got together and Mr. Johnson led them in prayer and he prayed and prayed and prayed for, you know, some sort of revelation for the cause of what was afflicting Mr. John Bell. And they finished their prayers, they get into bed, and the moment they extinguish the lights, the loud racket from the Bell's home starts up again. In the Johnson's home now. All the same noises, gnawing and lip smacking and stones and chairs and chains and dogs. Almost twofold, as if showing off to the Johnsons, well, this is real. This is real. The Johnsons themselves had their bed sheets flown off of them. And Mr. Johnson was freaked out, but he was a man of strong faith. He did not lose his head. Instead, he gained his composure, and he called out to the entity, and he demanded it reveal itself. And he said, in the name of the Lord, what or who are you? What do you want, and why are you here? And there was silence for a time, and the sound stopped. And I'm going to pause here and say, I think this is where they made their first mistake.
Oh, you think they made a mistake?
I think this addressing of the spirit.
Oh, like giving it a name or something?
Idea.
Or just talking to it in general.
Just giving it attention. We've heard many a story of what begins to happen when you start to give these things attention. It's like you give them a hook or you start to water a seed and they grow stronger and stronger.
To me, it's not even attention. It's you're literally asking them, hey, can you please show yourself? Which is obviously going to make things worse.
Yeah.
Like, why would you do that?
You're almost inviting it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what could they do? They're getting abused by it already. So they might as well try to learn something about it. But because it stopped for a time, and then started back up that night, even louder. But Mr. Johnson came to believe that there was an intelligence about this entity and that it could understand language to some extent because it kind of responded to his demand. It didn't speak or anything, but it stopped and then it came back. And so he begged the Bells and he said, you need to tell more people about this. We just need more people to try to help investigate what this is. Very reluctantly, they agreed. And soon, there was no end to the number of visitors and investigations that started to be done in the Bell's house. Many experiments were tried, and there was almost every single day, there were people over, either for the whole day or even overnight, whether it be close friends of the family, who were there to support them and try to distract them from the abuse that they were going to face and they were facing, or it was strangers from the community or eventually from faraway places who had heard about this and just wanted to experience it for themselves, or people who wanted to debunk it and came from far away. Poor Betsy faced more and more aggression as this went on, to the point where her parents feared for her life. And every night, as I said, one of her friends would stay with her and try to keep her company. But more and more, this thing would abuse Betsy. And now you might wonder, maybe Betsy was faking it or the family was faking it. But Betsy was sent out of the Bell home to stay in other people's homes all the time. And the phenomena and the abuse, the hair pulling, the sheets, and more physical abuse than that, followed her wherever she went. This started to make some skeptical people think that it was all her and she was faking it. But to the day they died, the family, the rest of the family, took extreme offense at that suggestion. So they tried their best to only tell very close friends and family for a time, but this was such a small, close-knit community, it just got out. People would show up and they'd start asking questions out loud to this entity in the house. And they'd say stuff like, how many horses are there in the barn? And they'd start to get answers in knocks.
Such a bad idea.
It's really not something
like,
you should
like
do.
Like, imagine they didn't, like, yeah, you're right. If they didn't even entertain it, it might have just gone away.
Maybe it would have gone away after a while. I don't know. It was already pretty bad. I don't know where it's yanking them and throwing the sheets around. But they start asking questions and getting intelligent responses. And again, you could say, maybe someone in the house is, you know, listening in and scratching on the wall or knocking on the wall.
There were 9 kids.
There were not a lot of kids. There were a lot of kids around. Objects like candles and logs, though, would be seen floating around at night outside. And now, young Joel, who was the youngest son, mm-hmm. also found himself the target of the physical abuse of the entity. At this point, this entity started to full-on slap people on the face. So I'm going to stop here and say, what I mean by this is, people inside the Bell home would feel an invisible force that felt like a hand out of nowhere come and slap them hard across the face. And when inspected, they would see handprints on their face. Nothing visible at this point. This started to happen when people would speak out against the entity, like make fun of it or taunt it. They would be slapped.
How many fingers?
I believe a normal 5 fingers.
Oh my god! Could you? It was 3. It was just a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
I was thinking details. Like 6.
Oh, like a giant?
Yeah, or some spirit of the land or something like that.
That's pretty good.
We actually get details of how the hands felt later on.
Oh.
This especially happened when the entity would try to yank sheets off of the bed and people would resist. They'd be like, no, these are my sheets. And then they'd feel, boom, slaps across the face. With all of this attention being put into it, all these people coming, asking it questions, being excited, being interested, the entity soon developed a voice. First, only low, broken sounds were heard. This was in response to visitors just begging for something to happen. But soon, after some time, it started developing into a weak, faltering whisper, just with random, indistinct words being formed. But eventually, it gained strength and became a barely audible whisper. But an understandable whisper. If no one else was speaking, it could be heard. And with this, at that point, this entity could now speak directly. And the sensation around the Bell house exploded. This only made more and more people come to interact with the spirit and try to get answers from it. I struggle to imagine what this was like. This was a time where this was on the border of evil devil stuff and just like the Holy Spirit coming and and speaking to people. These people were right. It was a really interesting religious period in the country's history where like this could have gone both ways. So people were interested in this and it gave them more and more reason to be interested.
This is even pre,
it's pre-spiritism. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Spiritualism. Yeah. That's like right around here, right after World War.
What are those sisters?
The Fox sisters.
Yeah. It's before them.
Yes, and that's very similar. That's knocking. I think that's upstate New York in the late 1800s or mid 1800s.
Something like that.
So there's a lot of curiosity around this and people are just talking to it and begging it. And so a lot of people come and they say, spirit, what are you from? Where are you from? And now it can speak. And the first answer it gives to this question is, quote, I am a spirit. I was once very happy, but have been disturbed. And that's all it said. But now that it had a voice, it was able to really mess with the Bell family. Right? One day, their son John Bell, so this is not John Bell Sr., this is John Bell Jr., he was discussing with family and friends some plans to visit North Carolina back where they came from and deal with some leftover family property. I think he wanted to sell it. In the middle of the conversation, this voice, this disembodied voice of the spirit spoke over them, prophesying, saying that if John went, he'd waste his time. He'd return empty-handed in months. And not only would he waste his time, but there was going to be a beautiful, eligible young lady passing by town who was rich and looking for someone to marry. Ooh. And if he didn't go, he'd be able to win her hand. But if he went on this trip, he'd waste his time and miss out on this opportunity. And John Jr. laughed and ridiculed the spirit, and he went on the trip. Well, 6 months later, he returned empty-handed. And his family confirmed he had missed the visit of the exact beautiful, wealthy young lady.
Yeah, but honestly, good for him not listening, not being tempted.
True.
Who cares?
Pretty beast. Not listening to disembodied spirits tell you what to do and not to do.
Smart guy.
But he wanted money anyway. So at least if he had stayed, he would have had money and a woman. So just
And also have fallen prey to this entity.
What if potentially a nice entity? What if it changed his mind and it's like, yo, family?
You're starting to sound like some of the recent MU episodes where the dark man is a nice guy.
It's a good question. I mean, people didn't know at this point how to feel about it. I mean, they weren't happy about the slapping, and the bells weren't happy about the hair pulling and the sheets and the floating stuff. And John Bell Sr. at this point was still keeping it secret, his mouth affliction, his stiffness of tongue. But the visitors were like, this is cool. This is crazy. This is like a novelty.
Yeah, but maybe because the bells weren't treating it like look at this neat thing we've got here, everybody. Yeah. Pay to go see it.
They refused money and they housed everyone and they fed everyone out of pocket. They were classic like Southern hospitality to the point where they were like really suffering financially because their house was filled with people all the time and they were just feeding people and just letting people stay and experience it. And they never accepted money.
And there was no Walmart.
There was no Walmart.
Yeah. So I'm thinking the spirit was kind of looking out for the Bell family. Like, you know, I know we had some bad blood in the past, but maybe we can make amends and you can kick all these people out and we can go back to going our separate ways.
Let us see. So another time, again, the spirit was asked, who are you? What do you want? And now gave a new answer. So start to piece together the themes of what the spirit says here. This time it says, I'm the spirit of a person who was buried in the woods nearby, and the grave has been disturbed. And one of my teeth was lost under this house, and I am here looking for that tooth, which I believe was my cold open. So a very specific story now, basically being like, oh, disturbed bones. There's bones underneath your house. That's why I'm disturbed. Find it. And, you know, so kind of random, but this triggers a memory in the Bells because they suddenly remember years and years ago, this happened. Oh. Family members had found Native American graves on the property and dug them up, looking for buried treasure. They don't find any treasure. Yeah.
Not even to build the house. They were just digging it up.
Nope.
Just to see if there was treasure.
They came across bones. They're like, let's see if there's gold here. Like those Indians probably buried with gold. Anyway, all they find is a jawbone. They take the jawbone back to the house and they're waving around. Ooh. And one of the local boys, so he wasn't even I would get so angry at this, by the way, Corbin Hall. So he's just a young guy in the neighborhood, a friend of the Bells, the Bell kids. He's holding the jawbone and he's frustrated that they didn't find any treasure. And he's at the Bell house and he hurls the jawbone against the wall in the house. Like, it's just like, this is stupid, and just throws it. The thing shatters and a tooth flies off and drops between the floorboards into the ground. And when John Bell Sr. gets home, he finds out and he chastises them. He's like, what are you guys doing? You can't do that with bones. Put those bones back. So they put the bones back and they search for the tooth, but they can't find it. And so they just forget it. Years later now, this entity is saying it's the spirit of that dead Native American. And so when they heard this years later, John Bell Sr. was freaked out. So he had the family rip up the floorboards and search for that tooth. I mean, it had been years. Nothing was found, of course. But after searching for hours and making a whole mess, the spirit starts cackling out loud around them, saying it was all a joke to fool old Jack. And old Jack is what she starts calling the dad, John Bell Sr.
Not Stingy Jack.
Not Stingy Jack. No, I was thinking that. I was thinking that.
They're not. Okay, so she doesn't know. Or it doesn't know. Bell Witch.
There were references to Jack-a-lanterns in the old 1800s book. So I'm curious how the wording changed, like the spelling changed over time. There are some interesting spellings of words, which are cool. So, but now it's just making up stories to meme on them and laughing at them. Not long after that, it gave a new answer about its origins. At this point, this is when the Bells had been suffering financially because they kept feeding everyone at no expense and always refusing payment. And one day, one of the local reverends, there were a handful of these Protestant ministers in the community, and they were all very close friends with each other. He asked the spirit again where it was from, and now it said, I am the spirit of an early immigrant who brought a large sum of money and buried my treasure for safekeeping until needed. In the meanwhile, I died without divulging the secret, and I have returned in the spirit for the purpose of making known the hiding place, and I want Betsy Bell to have the money. What?
Odd proclamation.
Very odd.
All the family has to do is just like bury a little bit of money just to, you know, unfreeze all the bank fees, you know.
Basically, right? But also, she hates Betsy. She's abusing Betsy. She's slapping her. She's pulling her hair. Now, all of a sudden, she wants her to have the buried treasure. And they asked the spirit for more details, and the spirit refused unless they agreed to abide by these terms. Drew Bell, one of the sons, and Bennett Porter go and dig it up, and every single dollar would go to Betsy and Mr. James Johnson, the family friend, who the spirit started calling Old Sugar Mouth, would oversee and count the money. And they were like, this is crazy. You're making this up. But then the spirit described the exact details of the location, the details of how it was buried and when and what to look for, and the big, big, big stone that's on top of the space, and it's between these two rivers, and it's under this tree, and look for this and go at this time. And they're just they're so convinced by the details. They know their land. They're like, we know where that is. That's a great spot for hiding money. They believe her. And so the spirit's like, you have to go tomorrow morning. Otherwise, people might find out and beat you to it. So the next morning, they go out. Drew and Bennett, they find it exactly as the spirit described. And they spend hours in the hard sun trying to dig up this huge stone that was in the way. They build levers, they, you know, form poles out of things, and they logs, and they lift the stone, and finally there's nothing there. And they go, okay, well, maybe the treasure had sunk deeper into the ground over the years. And so they dig, and they dig, and dig, until they dig 6 feet down, big hole, still nothing. They give up. They go home, exhausted, hungry. And what are they met by? Disembodied, cackling laughter, mocking them for being so easily fooled. Now the spirit starts describing to everyone in the house, laughing, the scene of those guys digging, a play-by-play of everything that was done, everything that was said, mocking them. And supposedly, it kept bringing the story up for a month to all the visitors, making fun of the two men that went out and wasted their whole day digging.
Sounds like something we would do.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just
not
like
digging,
so,
but bring up keep bringing something up.
It's such a trickster.
You know, I've re-listened to all this. I have my thoughts, but we'll get into those later.
Yes, I think
because.
Yeah.
I'm starting to make after hearing so many things over the years.
It
now,
is interesting. Like all the similarities.
I have a different opinion on what this is.
Oh, from when you first heard this story?
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's great.
And I think I'm right.
And again.
And you're wrong.
Really?
I have no idea what you're going to say.
I don't know what the hell to think about this. I mean, hundreds of people are seeing this, so,
and keep that in mind.
Okay,
Nick, are you gonna do your tulpa thing every, like you do every time?
Oh, maybe.
Continue. Well, I think I have okay. A good argument.
Okay. Now, the interesting part, which I am so creeped out by, because this started off as scratching on outside doors, and now it's a disembodied, loud voice. By this point, it was a full voice that could be heard over people. It is gaining energy. People would start conversing with it as if it was a person standing next to them. This next story really just, this rubs me the wrong way. This makes me so uncomfortable. So, back then on this frontier, there were very few church buildings, but the population was really religious, and it was a very active part of their personal and social lives. Families would often visit each other every day and pray and have Bible study together. People would have little altars in their own homes, and you would just go around and, oh, let's meet at the Johnson's today, let's meet at the Bells tomorrow. They were really into discussion, debate, singing hymns, the whole nine yards. And the spirit developed a zeal for religious discussion itself. So first, it started to mimic the exact voice and tone and mannerisms of James Johnson, who often led religious gatherings when the two local ministers were away. And it would perfectly quote his sermons, his songs, his prayers, not just the words he said, but his voice. It was impersonating his voice to the point where they couldn't even tell it was an impersonation. This was now no longer just at nighttime. This was during broad daylight. It would just sing any hymn from any of the known hymn books that were used at the time. And it could quote any passage from the Bible from beginning to end. And people loved this. They would test it. They would flip through the Bible and just randomly point, and they would just say, Luke chapter 9, verse 2. And immediately the voice.
Two Maccabees.
Three Habakkuk.
Five Zebediah.
Five Zebediah. And immediately the voice would recite the line without any hesitation. Weird as that is, it would also correct people if they misquoted a verse. And not only this, this disembodied voice would argue for and against doctrine with the ministers, and often would be considered to win the arguments from the nonstop flood of quotes and references to Bible passages that it could just provide.
I'll say,
what the hell is this?
For that point, though, the interpretations of the Bible from a Protestant point of view, and even 200 years ago.
I would love to know what the interpretations that this spirit, like, what opinions was it taking? What
exactly. Sides? So it's like, who knows? And also, who knows what they were, like, the actual humans were thinking?
I'm
like,
so curious. I wish
Protestantism has, you know, evolved.
Yeah. So yeah. Really,
So what does it mean they won the argument?
I don't know. I wish there was more detail here.
It seems like it was just able to quote information better, that like if I was making a point and like somewhere else in the Bible it said something different, it would be able, the spirit would be able to correct you and say, it's like fact checking.
Yeah.
And I think shutting them down.
Yeah, if I had an encyclopedic knowledge of a book and then we were discussing the book, I would be able to beat you in any argument related to that book and the meanings from that book.
There's a term for this. It's called a gish gallop. Oh. And it's when people have a debate. I don't know. It's not necessarily just for religious debates, but it's often used to describe religious debates where someone says, here's my point. And then they just list 100 verses. They just go, the preface so is like John chapter 3, verse 16, Luke chapter 3, verse 2.
Just, they just inundate you with stuff.
Exactly. And you, because it's easy to provide that, and it's hard and time consuming to say, okay, let's go through that. So let's go. So basically,
maybe that's what happened.
It's basically gish galloping, just being like, I can quote anything. It has this knowledge of things that it shouldn't have knowledge about. Why is it?
Don't worry, I have an explanation.
Okay, Aaron, what do you think?
I think this is the spirit of ChatGPT.
Oh my god, we just captured it 200. You know, like,
or it becomes powerful enough where it time travels.
It's just the first large language model,
but only for the Bible.
No, I mean it knows other stuff too.
Oh, it does.
It knows locations. You upload an image, it now has that image.
It's just, it's that, what is his name? Rainbow. It's the GeoGuessr guy.
No, it basically is. It gets to a point where it's almost omniscient. The only thing it can't tell are like people's inner thoughts, but it sees everything and hears everything. Even, well, actually, that's exactly next. So quoting the Bible, some disembodied voice, it just feels wrong to me. Because I'm like, of course, I'm like, oh, this is like demonic. And it's like, it's singing the songs and it's like referencing Jesus and it's quoting the Bible. It's so weird. It's so weird. One day, a visitor from out of town named John was arguing in the bell house during one of these, you know, religious discussions that there was nothing wrong with stealing food if you were starving and you had no other way of obtaining food. And the disembodied spirit quipped out of nowhere, oh, so did you eat that sheepskin, John? And John shut right up and left. Now, it came to light a little bit later. People asked, like, what happened? Many, many years ago, back in his hometown, out of state, he had been accused of stealing a sheepskin. So now the spirit is showing knowledge of stuff from people's personal history from years before it showed up, from miles and miles and miles away from it currently is. How is it doing this? And
counterpoint, it already could do that, right? If you remember, John's gonna come back home broke John Jr.
Yeah.
So
it could tell the future and the past.
Yeah, but like that was also a good distance away.
That is true.
How would it know the prospects from that distance away? Just saying.
That's a very good point. Yeah, it's not super cool, like what it knows, what it can't know, but it becomes quite the tattler and gossip at this point. And it starts keeping an eye on all the going ons in the region. And people would gossip with it. They'd ask like, oh, what is Anne up to over there? And she'd be like, the spirit, which had a feminine voice, by the way, which is why I'm using she, even though it never really came out and said I'm female or I'm male or anything. It would be like, Anne and her husband aren't sleeping together anymore. They're, you know, her husband's drinking too much and beating her. It'd be like revealing secrets. And it got to a point where supposedly people in the community were all kind of on high alert and were all very nice and kind to each other because everyone's secrets kept getting aired like dirty laundry by the spirit in the bell house. One day, someone asked, what's going on in the Johnson's house? And the spirit said, hold on, let me see. And 5 minutes later, came back and gave a little report on what was going on. And the next day, they asked the Johnsons, and it was like, oh my God, that is what we were doing last night at 9 o'clock. However, a really startling and head scratcher, one night, the voice was speaking to everyone after dinner, and some of the reverends were over, and Reverend Gunn had just preached that morning a few miles away, and the voice started discussing Gunn's sermon that he gave, like quoting it. And Reverend Gunn was like, again, speaking to this disembodied voice, what the hell's going on? He's like, how could you have heard it? It wasn't anywhere near here. It was miles away in the morning. And the spirit said, I was present and I heard you, and quoted lines. Everyone was stunned. Now, there was another reverend there, Reverend Fort, and he happened to have preached at that same time in the morning somewhere 6 miles south. So he quipped to the spirit, oh, well, I have the advantage on you because you didn't hear mine. And the spirit said, oh, no, I heard yours too. I was there and I heard you. And proceeded to again quote lines from his sermon too. So now it's bilocating.
It's omnipresent.
It's omnipresent and not omniscient because it doesn't, I guess, can't read people's minds, but like it sees and hears everything and can tell things about, I don't know, very interesting. Now, whenever this spirit would appear and interact with people, Betsy would typically fall quite ill. She'd become lightheaded. She'd often faint. People said she'd look like death. She'd look drained. And she was a very beautiful, very healthy, typically young woman. But whenever the spirit was out and about, she looked like on death's doorstep. And whenever it went away, she would recover. And the abuse that the spirit directed at Betsy grew worse and worse and worse, targeting her and her father, John Sr. And it soon came to a point where the spirit promised to torment old Jack Bell to the end of his life. Over time, as we're talking, as the years passed, it started to focus more and more on John, shifting a little bit from Betsy, but these two, John and Betsy, and one of the younger sons, Joel, really faced the brunt of the abuse. Nonstop visitors would ask, again, what's your origin story? Where are you from? And it would always change its mind. And this is where we get a name for the entity. It claimed to be a child buried in North Carolina. Then they claim to be John Johnson's stepmother's witch. Now, have you guys ever heard of someone being someone's witch?
No, I've heard of witches having fetishes.
Oh yeah, what is that? Is that like,
it's like a familiar?
Familiar. Okay.
Yeah.
So I hadn't heard this turn of phrase used before, but it made the quote, the title Bell Witch, make sense. So when we think of witch, we probably think of, you know, crooked nose, pointed hat witch. But that's not all it referred to back then, and it certainly didn't. That's not what the image of a witch was. Back then, a witch also referred to a sort of familiar, like an assistant spirit that a witch used to do its bidding. So in this case, witch was synonymous with like spirit or entity, kind of similar to, I have it in my notes, an egregore or a tulpa. So the bell witch doesn't mean cackling, ha ha ha, witch.
Although it did cackle.
But it means disembodied spirit. Now, one of these origin stories that this spirit threw out stuck. And it kind of sucks that it stuck. It's actually really unfortunate. Because to me, it's clearly, and to the family and to the people at the time, it was another one of the cruel pranks that the spirit played. But it stuck. So one day, Reverend Gunn was begging the spirit to just tell the truth. What are you from? What are you about? And finally, it admitted it would tell the truth. It said it'd be terrible to lie to a minister. It said, I'm old Kate Batts witch. And I'm determined to torment old Jack Bell for the rest of his life. Now,
pleasant.
Who was Kate Batts? This is the connection to Sarah's old episode. Do you guys remember Angeline Tubbs, the weird old lady that was accused of being a witch in Saratoga?
Yep. Yes.
Kate Batt was somewhat similar in the fate that she faced. She was a local strange woman in the community that faced a lot of suspicion and superstition because, well, she was super duper fat and weird. And she was married to Frederick Batts, who is pretty much an invalid, confined to bed. So totally like unable to do anything. Kate Batts had to manage the entire family estate and affairs. And they were a wealthy family that had farms and slaves and a lot of work to do. And she managed it very well, was very business oriented, very, you know, wary of men taking advantage of her. But she was very eccentric. Very sensitive. And she tried to act aristocratic. So she used really big, probably made up words wherever she went, which made her like a total laughing stock behind her back.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
I have some examples of that in a moment. Nice. So she also had like a super weak son that she tried to marry to like any of the young women in the town. So they hated her. They'd like run when they saw her. And her son was so skinny and sickly that he was called a bean pole.
Bean pole.
Which I'd never heard, but I looked up. It means like a really, really skinny, lanky guy.
I'm
definitely not familiar. No, I'm definitely not familiar with that. I've never seen such a person before in the mirror.
Me? Did you say in the mirror?
Yeah. Wait, what were you going to say?
I was thinking of you, but
yeah, okay.
I wasn't going to say in the mirror. you self-deprecated yourself.
Yeah, but you do it. So there were rumors that she was a witch because she was just weird, but only superstitious people thought that. So otherwise she was pretty kind and caring and very sharp wit. And she was famous for viciously verbally abusing anyone that she didn't like. She was pretty funny with that.
Pleasant.
And the funniest thing, I think, she had an old gray horse, but she never rode it. She probably couldn't. She would just saddle it up and just take walks with it and an entourage of like some servants and slaves.
Wow.
And go around town like that.
Interesting.
And so people called that group Kate Batts' troops. As weird as she was, though, she was a devout Christian just like the rest of them. And so this will probably explain why people didn't like her. On one occasion, there was a Reverend Thomas Feltz, and he was leading a revival meeting, which, as far as I could tell, was like a multi-day long religious meeting where people really get caught up in the fervor and confess and repent in front of everyone. And they're like, oh, I'm saved. You know, the whole classic thing, right? So this whole congregation, they're chanting, they're swaying. And Feltz had just finished a particularly moving sermon. And one local guy that, you know, was a troubled guy, Joe Edwards, he's on all fours on the floor in the center of a crowd that's chanting and praying and begging. And he's on the verge of being like, I give up my life to the Lord. Save me. I repent.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's encouraging him. They're super anxious. At that moment, Kate Batt's troops arrive outside and she feels the excitement. So she quickly ties her horse and she sprints inside, elbows everyone out of the way, and jumps and sits on the guy. And poor Joe Edwards, he's in the middle of like religious convulsions. He doesn't know what's going on. So he starts screaming that the devil's on top of him.
Oh my God.
He's like, I'm sinking. Save me, Lord. Save me, Lord. And the Reverend is like, Miss Batts or Mrs. Batts, please, can you find another seat? And she quotes, puts on airs, and she declines. And she goes, no, I thank you. This is consoling to my disposition that I feel amply corrugated. Now, I looked up corrugated and it means having corrugations made of corrugated material. That doesn't help. It means like jagged.
I feel amply jagged.
Like you have paper that has, I think it seems like perforated.
Isn't there like corrugated steel? Isn't that a thing?
Yeah. Exactly. So that makes no sense.
Maybe it had a different meaning 200 years ago.
Maybe.
It says shaped into alternate ridges and grooves.
Yeah, so she was feeling particularly
so it
shaped.
It could be grooved. So it meant she was comfortable.
She was right? Feeling groovy.
Oh, I see. No, oh, you're saying like she feels like right. She's like in like...
In yeah, a, like, you know how you get like a real good like butt groove in the couch?
Oh.
Yeah, this was a butt groove in
a person.
This poor guy.
Aaron, that's some good etymology.
I still don't think corrugated is the proper word there.
Well, she's...
No, but that's the only thing I can figure.
Well, she's told, like, you're suffocating the guy. And she goes, oh, that don't disperse my perspicuity. Can you look up perspicuity? I'm a very plain woman and do love to homagate near the altar where the Lord am making confugation among the sinners.
So... perspicuity is the quality of being clear and easy to understand.
Don't disperse my
Disperse my perspicuity, Aaron.
Mm.
So don't get it twisted.
I guess. What about homagate?
This one doesn't even come up as a real word. H-O-M-I-G-A-T-E. This is not a word.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
H-O-M-I-G-A-T-E.
This is just made up. And she's like, she gets told, you're killing the guy. He can't breathe. And she goes, yes, bless Jesus. Let him suffocate. He's getting closer to the Lord. And basically, this is, as it sounds to us, this is so comical. You know, when you're in church, and we, the three of us have experienced this in the past. And
yep.
So... it's a time when you're not supposed to be laughing. You're supposed to be solemn. And the tiniest little seed of something funny makes it so hard to not laugh. People have to run out of the church to burst into laughter outside because this is so comical.
Sounds about right.
The entire like sermon, like the entire meeting just has to end here because people are just holding in their laughter or running outside to laugh. So...
Frank would never last. He'd never make it out the door.
I really wouldn't.
I would
I'm the
point
guy.
Out,
that, oh, don't say, you say it.
I would point out the hymns and find the closest among us and point it out to Frank, and he'd start chuckling under his breath.
That's so true. That's a true story. That really gets me.
That never happened.
Definitely never happened.
Never.
So because of these stories, when the spirit was like, I'm Kate Bat's witch, a bunch of people were just like, that fits. And they just started to believe that this was true, even though all of the other origin stories were made up. So poor Kate Batts, who was a normal fine lady, was pretty upset that now she gets roped into this, and people are like, oh my God, Kate Batt has something against the Bells and is haunting them. She's an evil witch. And Kate Batts outlived the Bells, outlived John Bell for decades, and just had to deal with this. And the Bells didn't believe it had anything to do with Kate Batts. Neither did the close people, the Johnsons, Reverend Gunn, but a lot of the superstitious people in the community just ran with this. And from this point on, everyone referred to this entity as Kate. So I'm going to refer to this entity as Kate, even though I want to make it clear, I don't think there's any truth to this story. Kate, the spirit, was just, you know, causing more mischief. So poor Kate Batts has this thrown at her, and soon after the Kate name drop, the story gets a million times weirder when a handful of, let's call them, ethereal visitors join Kate. We're going to end part one here. We'll pick up with part two next week. We will learn about the troop of four characters that show up to cause mayhem, the continued abuse and strengthening of attacks that Kate and her troop cause, including more physical attacks, physical embodiments, scaring away psychics and skeptics and detectives, and the harrowing and really sad end for both Betsy Bell and John Bell Sr. So thank you for listening to part one. Give us a like and leave a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. Check the show notes for the sources here, and be sure to tune in next time. And remember, if you start hearing scratches and dogs and wings and stones and chains, as hard as it might be, don't give it any more attention. We'll see you next time.